And you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Think of it. Ours is the only species in all the long period of life on Earth that has ever spread around the entire world, occupying every continent and nearly every island, effectively subjugating all the animals and plants and natural systems it has encountered, and over a relatively short period of time, establishing itself in vast numbers as the single most dominant species of all. So begins a new book by Kirkpatrick Sale entitled After Eden, The Evolution of Human Domination. The book considers not only the human tendency to dominate, but examines that tendency's origins, not with the first hominids, but, the author claims, with the development of big game hunting, and how that fostered certain attitudes toward nature and the world around us. Sale also suggests an alternative to the exploit and consume everything paradigm. His alternative harkens back to an egalitarian, in harmony with nature outlook that he associates with Homo erectus. Kirkpatrick Sale is a contributing editor to The Nation magazine and the acclaimed author of a dozen books, including The Fire of His Genius, Robert Fulton and the American Dream, and The Conquest of Paradise, Christopher Columbus and the Columbian Legacy. We are still trying to get Kirkpatrick Sale on the phone. It should be just a moment. So before I actually interview him live on this program, let me tell you a little bit about this book by reading a bit more from the introduction, which is very interesting. And he writes that, "I want to say that the most important questions for our time are without doubt, how did we get into this predicament? How did humankind develop the attitude that it was right and good for it to dominate nature as much as possible, to regard the earth and its creatures and its habitats as therefore unconstrained human consumption and manipulation? And how can humankind possibly alter that perception, learn to live in balance with nature as we once did during the long ages that made up 99% of the time humans have been on Earth?" I'm reading again from After Eden, The Evolution of Human Domination, and I understand we have Kirkpatrick Sale on by phone from New York. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Let me start by asking you to expand, I guess I just did by reading a little bit more from your book, but to expand upon this attitude toward nature that Western civilization has promoted and where it's gotten us.
Not only Western civilization, actually all civilizations are dependent upon the exploitation of nature, and the empires that they construct are perfected instruments at doing this exploitation. And that's one reason that this is a phenomenon that has taken place around the entire Earth, wherever Homo sapiens have gone to. They have exploited the Earth and gotten better and better at it with every passing year, until we now find ourselves in this predicament, of which global warming, much talked about now, is only one sign of the kinds of troubles that we are in. The ecological footprint of humans now is so great as to be too large for the planet to sustain, as Edward Wilson of Harvard has said, that the impact of our domination begins to threaten the very survival of the species.
Let me start where you start in Chapter 1, which is a volcano on the island of Sumatra, as we call it today. About 71,000 years ago, it erupted. And how did this enormous eruption affect the planet's climate?
Well, it was probably the most violent and incidentally loudest explosion that the Earth has ever known, or at least since the destruction of the dinosaurs a billion years ago. It was Mount Toba. Shot ash and particles into the air that that made the Earth turn immediately dark, not just in Indonesia and the East, but eventually around the globe. And it is thought that this kind of volcanic winter would have reduced temperatures everywhere, maybe 15 to 25, and in some places up to 75 degrees, a very significant turn in the climate. And my thesis is that it's in response to that tragedy, that terrible event, that people turned for the first time to the hunting and killing of wild, large mammals.
Didn't Homo sapiens hunt before this volcanic event?
Well, there's no evidence of it. It is possible that they might have used nets, say, to catch small animals. But nets don't fossilize, so we don't know. And the evidence that we do know is largely that humans were scavengers up until this time, up until this crisis that led them to take on fellow creatures as food.
So given the climatic conditions caused by the eruption of this volcano, again about 71,000 years ago, how fundamental did hunting, and specifically the hunting of big animals, become for Homo sapiens?
Well, it must have been crucial right from the beginning as a food supply. And we can tell this by the number and variety of spear points that do fossilize, and we have evidence of, and by the enormous variety and numbers of animal bones that are found in the caves, particularly where the first spear points are found, which is in southern Africa, around the whole rim of southern Africa, the caves leading out onto the oceans, the caves on the rivers. It is there that we find this extraordinary variety and number of animal bones for the first time. And so we can posit that this must have been a complete change of culture for these people. Not just a complete change of diet, but that hunting became the thing that kept them alive, and therefore obviously must have been a source of ritual of all kinds, so important that it would have occupied the central part of that southern African culture.
Right. In other words, other aspects, other parts of humans' food supply at the time were affected adversely by the climatic change caused by the volcanic eruption, and therefore humans had to change focus a bit.
It's probably true that that most of the plant life that people had depended on would have been destroyed over the 8 or 10 year period of this volcanic winter, except that which is in the ground, whatever kind of tubers people were used to eating. And interestingly enough, it is at this time that we find some evidence of these people in southern Africa using fire to clear fields, and then realize that the tubers underneath that would grow larger in response to those fires. And so they were eating tubers as well as eating meat. But you can imagine that the meat it was that played the central role.
Kirkpatrick Sale joins us by phone from New York. He's contributing editor of The Nation magazine, former editor at The New York Times magazine. He's author of a dozen books, including The Conquest of Paradise, Christopher Columbus and the Columbian Legacy, Rebels Against the Future, The Luddites and Their War on the Industrial Revolution, Lessons for the Computer Age, and The Fire of His Genius, Robert Fulton and the American Dream. We're talking about his most recent book, After Eden, The Evolution of Human Domination, published by Duke University Press. The program is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. So this increased, or the beginnings, as you're suggesting, of the hunting of big game animals and the fundamental part of human life that it becomes, together with this use of fire to essentially, as you suggest in your book, to farm, because as you said, they knew that burning ground would help the growth of these tubers. What does this have to do with humans' sense of themselves, of their selves and the animals around them?
Well, here, of course, we can only speculate, but it seems to me if anybody has ever engaged in hunting, the killing of large animals and observing the pain, the anguish, the blood that comes from this, and if you can imagine that you make this a daily way of life, you then have to understand that there's got to be psychological changes that take place in you, you as an individual, you as a tribe, you as a society, so that you see these animals as estranged from you, and in some ways an enemy to you, something that you go after and kill. And so therefore you develop in the society the rituals and psychological ways of life that allow you to see these as the other, as the enemy, as legitimate to kill. You have to devise a whole different way of looking at the world, completely different from the people who had gone before, from the Homo erectus that had gone before, who had a harmonious relationship with nature, did not hunt, did not kill large animals, and therefore did not need to develop an attitude of opposition to nature. And I think it's the long development of that opposition to nature, beginning with opposition and estrangement from fellow creatures, that gets more and more developed as the eons go by, until eventually we humans get so good at killing these animals with a variety of weapons and a variety of strategies that we actually begin to kill them out, to exterminate them. This is some 50,000 years later, in a period around 20,000 years ago. But it is a long process of developing a culture and a practice of enmity to our fellow creatures.
You write about art, the emergence of something that might be called art in relation to hunting magic. What is hunting magic, and what does its emergence say about, again, the sapiens worldview?
Well, not all archaeologists are convinced that the extraordinarily brilliant and interesting cave art and the sculptures that go along with it are done for hunting magic, but it seems to me that there's no other reasonable explanation for it, particularly since this art begins to develop mostly in Europe at a time of great crisis, when there are an influx of people coming in from Middle Asia into Western Europe, particularly southern France, northern Spain, which had the warmest climate during a period from about 35,000 years on. The cold hits Europe and Asia in a major way, and there's an influx of population, a packing of population in a very small geographic area, and therefore an increased competition for these animals, increased competition between hunting societies. And it is just then 35,000 years ago, that we see the first cave art. So I'm convinced that this cave art is done in response to a crisis. And the crisis is a food crisis, and they paint the pictures of the animals that they want to kill on the wall with enormous skill, and with such skill in so many places that we know that this was an important part of their life, an important ritual to secure the food that they needed to secure. It's not put there on the walls as something pretty. It's put there in a matter of desperation so as to guide the hunt and allow these people to get the meat that they needed to eat.
Kirkpatrick Sale, we're talking about his most recent book, After Eden, The Evolution of Human Domination.
It's extraordinary to think that we got so good at killing the animals that we killed them off. The business of extinction, I mean, there were herds and herds of mammoth that covered the plains. But by sometime around, maybe 17,000 years ago, there weren't any. They were gone. And we continued to do this with increasing numbers of herds of different kinds of animals until at least 80% in some places of the major megafaunal species were exterminated, which in turn, of course, would seem naturally to lead to another food crisis. And that, I think, is the one that led us to agriculture.
You're right that agriculture began around 12,000 years ago or sometime after that. What impact did that have once it became an established way of life? What impact did it have on, again, this propensity and ability of humans to control nature?
An enormous impact. The idea that you could domesticate plants, which is what agriculture essentially is, and then domesticate animals, is in fact the enslavement of these species. That's what domestication is all about. We clearly began by going to stands of wild grains and knocking off in the early spring, knocking off the seeds and making mush out of those seeds as something to eat. It would argue that humans must have been fairly desperate at this point as a result of knocking off their meat source. So they turned to making mush and stews, and eventually they figured out breads out of these grains. And then they figured out that they could take those seeds and plant them in one place and live where those seeds came up. But then they'd have to live there all year long. And for the first time, life became sedentary. For the first time, the people stayed in one place all their lives. And the impact that this had on all aspects of life was enormous, including the very stature of the human animal, the very size of the human brain, both of which decreased after agriculture.
Hmm. You write in your book, After Eden, hunting had certainly had its impact on local ecosystems, especially hunting to extinction. But now with deforestation, dams and irrigation, soil exhaustion, extensive settlements, and all that goes with agriculture, almost all natural systems were disrupted and degraded. We were declaring war not just on a species, but on a world. To which some people, Kirk, would say, well, expanding population, need for food, what else would humans do?
Well, if humans have the attitude that they can dominate and should dominate, there would be no other choice for them. But that's exactly the problem, as I see it, that there is that sense that this is right and good. It is right and good that we should have more numbers, and if we have more numbers, then we should have more food, and we should have more food any way we can get it, including ultimately the enslavement of the few animals that could be domesticated. It's actually a fairly small number of animals that can be domesticated, but we found them and we did it. That simply ratified our attitude that it is right and good for humans to dominate. And the it, it, it goes along with the sense that the food will always be there. But of course, they had found out previously that it wouldn't always be there. That should have meant a sense of caution for the people who turned to agriculture. And it's my belief that, in fact, in North America, it did lead to a sense of caution. That after the people who came from Asia settled in North America, there too, a great extinction of the mammalian population, after that, you begin to see the Indians developing different ways of understanding and relating to nature, including animals and including hunting. A change from what obviously was an all-out blitzkrieg as they came into the continent at the beginning, to the kind of respectful hunting rituals that we know from historical times that the Indians had developed. But in most places in the world, it didn't develop that. In most places in the world, the people went at agriculture and husbandry the same way they had gone at killing animals. And that was all out. Anything the humans wanted to do is right and just and good. It doesn't matter that repeatedly the civilizations who did this failed. And they failed, at least for one reason, because they destroyed the very environment that they depended on. That is the pattern of empires since the first empires of 4000 B.C. The empires think that it's right and just to dominate the earth and do it any way that they can. And ultimately, they destroy the earth that they depend upon.
You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. Associate producer Esther Mania is at the controls. My name is C.S. Song. Kirkpatrick Sale is former editor at the New York Times Magazine, member of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. His books include The Green Revolution, The American Environmental Movement, 1962 to 1992, The Fire of His Genius, The Conquest of Paradise, and we're talking about his latest book, After Eden, The Evolution of Human Domination. Let's talk about, just briefly, before we get into the alternative, because you're not just in this book, you're not just about, kind of criticizing a certain paradigm and condemning it, in fact, but you want to pose something healthier and saner and more ecologically conscious, and you've already begun to suggest what that is. But before we do that, tell us a little bit about the evidence that we find after the introduction of cave art of deliberate human burials. What do these burials imply about human attitudes toward death at that time?
That's an interesting aspect of this story. And it's a fascinating story, which I've never known until I started going into this some 5 or 6 years ago, that there is no firm evidence of human burials till about 30,000 years ago. There are some cases where there seems to have been bodies that were put under the earth, but without any sign that this was a ritual, without any what anthropologists call grave goods, that is to say pieces of art or weapons or food that would be used in the afterlife. It is not until about 30,000 years ago, again at this period of particular rivalry and difficulty in Europe, that we find the first true burials. And that means, obviously, a belief in an afterlife, and that is, in effect, religion. This is the birth of religion. Another ritual enabling humans to survive and to justify their way of domination. Interestingly enough, the early burials in some places indicate that the societies had hierarchies, that there were chosen people who would go to the ground after dead with all kinds of jewelry, with thousands of pieces of jewelry, and then some that weren't in that same area, that same society, indicating that as early as 30,000 years ago, humans developed hierarchy. Again, another means of domination, and it's another symptom of a society that is no longer in harmony, not only with the natural world, but not in harmony with itself, because hierarchy is a simple form of human domination of humans.
Let's talk about Homo erectus. It emerged in Africa about 1.8 million years ago, died out about 30,000 years ago. So it lasted an incredibly long time. And you are obviously, and you say in this book, you're not suggesting that we live an erectus life in the world as it exists today. But there's something about the erectus consciousness that you want to commend to us. What is that?
This was the most extraordinary, the most successful human species among the many human species that have existed, and for such a long period of time, that it must have been doing something right, I figure. And what we can see is generally that these were people who scavenged and foraged for food and did not develop large animal hunting. There would have been nothing from their lives fossilizes to indicate anything like hunting. And therefore, we can assume that these are people who went down to the watering hole with all the rest of the species and drank there with the lions and the lambs, and that there was no adversarial relationship with the animals or with the rest of nature. And that, I would argue, is why they were so successful for such a long period of time. Of course, as soon as the sapiens develop hunting, they induce fear in all of the animals, and there's no such thing as going down to the watering hole side by side. This was exactly what the Bible had foretold, that after Eden, the Bible says, the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth. But that's only after Eden. That's only after hunting. Before that, we lived in harmony with the animals of the world, and we saw the world as a good place, not as a fearful place, not as a place where you had to rest your living by destroying animals and fellow creatures. And I argue that we can get back to that kind of consciousness again. It would take an effort, but we can see the folly of the path that we have led and the danger of being a creature dominating the earth to the point where we face our own extinction. We can see the folly of that road. So there must be another road, and we must develop a society with other ways of thinking about nature, of thinking what humans' place is in the world, a kind of humility in the world. As Thomas Berry once put it, understanding ourselves on the animal level, on the species level, not as something that can and deserves a right to control all of the species and the ecosystems of the earth. But
and to what extent do you think that humans, modern humans, are innately wired to think in that way?
I think the wiring is to think as a harmonious being, as a fellow creature. I think that's what 2 million years of living as Homo erectus did to us. I grant you that living for 70,000 years as Homo species, sapien species, with hunting and domination as our practice, has had a certain effect upon our mind. But deep inside all of us is that erectus sense, that eternal sense that we've had from the very beginning of our human species.
To what extent, I think you've talked about this a little bit before, but how about the question of the egalitarian or hierarchical nature of Homo erectus societies and what we might learn from that?
Well, again, we understand that harmony in nature allows and promotes harmony within human societies. And what we can mostly tell from the record of the erectus societies were they egalitarian, and that there did not seem to be great differences between the sexes, which could argue for a sexual egalitarianism, as many have for these Homo erectus. And there's another way of going at it, which is to look at some of the societies that have survived to today, Stone Age societies that have survived at the edges of the world today, and we can see among a great many of them features of that Homo erectus society. That, for one thing, they are egalitarian, another that they are peaceful, and another they regard the earth as good. It isn't a matter of opposing the earth. The earth is good. This is quite different than what we can imagine, what we can imagine for sapien societies in general. After we got kicked out of Eden, we didn't see the earth as good. And that has been the story of human civilization, not seeing the earth as good.
A couple minutes left with Kirkpatrick Sale. What can we take, Kirk, from erectus society's tendency to total perhaps 400 to 500 people in a larger community with the same dialect and culture? What can we take from that?
Well, obviously, there's something in our basic human natures that suggests that we shouldn't be living in large agglomerations the way we do. That maybe 500 is a special magic number in our very souls. At the size that we should try to think about our communities. This begins the whole task of trying to think about the size of the human species as it is today and trying to diminish that, but the size of our units of living to diminish them as well, and to diminish, not only diminish their ecological footprint, their disastrous ecological footprint, as we see in cities today, but to increase the chances for harmony and democracy at smaller scale levels. This is a lesson that these early societies can teach us. I don't mean to say that it'll be easy for us to do it, but at least we can say this is the direction we should be going in.
Kirkpatrick Sale, author of many acclaimed books, and the author of an incredibly, to me, fascinating, interesting, and important book published by Duke University Press. It's entitled After Eden, The Evolution of Human Domination. Kirk, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
You're very kind to have me. You're the first interview that I've given on this book, and it's been a real joy. Thank you.
Kirkpatrick Sale, thank you so much. And you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. I'm C.S. Song. Associate producer Esther Mania is at the controls.